Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
I need to cut that short because it just keeps going on for another like 20 seconds of just kind of, and it sounds like it's just abrupt. Anyway, this is Docs Who Lift podcast. Dr. Spencer, your host, and I got my co-host, Dr. Carl, and we got Hormones Demystified back again, and we're going to be talking about thyroid testing because he is a super expert on this. We talked about it last time. He has a whole blog all about some of the wacky testing ideas that some of these alternative practitioners put out there. But actually, again, I actually use his blog for reference when I'm trying to discuss with patients why some of these more out of the, I wouldn't even say out of the box, I'd say out of this realm testing is recommended by some of these people. Mm-hmm. So again, Hormones Demystified, if you haven't checked his blog out, go check it out. But we're going to be talking about thyroid testing.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. All right. Do we want to talk about the basics first of thyroid testing? We've done it before on some of our podcasts, but let's talk about kind of the standard stuff you see. And if you go to the doctor, you're like, I'm tired. I think it's my thyroid. What are the standard tests that people are getting? And then we'll go into some of these more wacky stuff.
Yeah. So most likely, the primary screening test is going to be thyroid stimulating hormone known as TSH. And that is the hormone that is made by the pituitary gland in the brain. And it basically tells the thyroid to put out thyroid hormone. And it's a very sensitive blood test. So essentially, if thyroid hormone levels are dropping even a tiny bit, even within the normal range, but not normal for your body, since everyone kind of likes to keep their thyroid hormone level in a very tightly regulated portion of that normal range, you drop a tiny bit within the normal range, your TSH should jump up out of proportion to that tiny little change. So the TSH, if it's high, it suggests, hey, maybe there's an underactive thyroid going on here. So that's almost always going to be the first test.
How high
test
is high, by the way? Test. How high is high for TSH?
Yeah. Great question. Lots of arguments and controversy about that. I mean, I would say that most labs are going to have a normal range that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 0.4 to 4.0. Yeah. So upper limit of normal, 4.0. We can talk a little bit more about some subtleties there about kind of a high normal TSH and in what under what circumstances that might reflect that someone's brewing hypothyroidism.
Okay.
So we can certainly jump into that, but if it's, you know, above four, I'm going to start looking at it a little more closely.
Okay.
So people might hear the term subclinical hypothyroidism too. So I don't know if you want to touch on that. Obviously, you and I probably get a lot of those referrals. Sure. So what is subclinical hypothyroidism?
Yeah, subclinical. You know, I think some people might surmise that it means, you know, that it's not really a clinical problem, but it can be a clinical problem. Yeah, it's more of a biochemical diagnosis. Yeah,
it's like a misnomer, really. It really shouldn't be called that, actually.
Yeah, it shouldn't be. You know, it should be called maybe borderline hypothyroidism or something like that. But,
yeah,
you know, the TSH is slightly elevated, but the free T4, which is the thyroid hormone level, is within the normal range. And that's usually what we mean when we say subclinical.
Okay, yeah. So normal range is a free T4. I know I'm grilling you, but this is important because when we start getting into, I'm going to go over my case and some other cases that we can kind of discuss. So yeah. What's a normal free T4 level?
That's a tougher one to answer since different labs use different assays, but I'm going to say that for the lab that I was most familiar with, it was, I think, around 0.6 to 1.2. 2 or 1.4 or something like that.
I think I see 0.8 to 1.4.
I see 0.6 to like 1.6, ironically. So these reference ranges for people, people also don't understand that lab assays are not perfect.
Right? Yeah. And we need to have a podcast all about that because they're because cholesterol and all those different things, how they actually do these labs. Anyway, that's an aside.
These things are not perfect, but and also, I guess I would like to just point out one thing. We are talking about what we call primary hypothyroidism, and that's when the thyroid itself is not working, or if we had hyperthyroidism, where the thyroid itself is working too hard. Because, again, you and I probably get referrals for central hypothyroidism, where there's hypothalamic pituitary disease of, you know, whatever flavor. And then that totally changes what we're talking about, just for listeners out there. But, okay, that was a sidetrack, but just so we're clear.
I'll also put in a little plug for people to, when they're listening to something like this, just pay attention to the units as well, because sometimes there are different assays that measure the same analyte, like, for example, free T4, and you just want to make sure that, you know, when we're talking about these numbers, you know, if we're talking about the numbers, like, is it nanograms per deciliter, is it micrograms per liter, you know, what is it? Just to make sure that you're carrying over the numbers into your situation that actually do indeed apply to your situation.
Yeah, and that changes where you live too, by the way. So you know, in Europe, the units that they're using are different. You know, just for example, I just happen to pull up you know, reference range for this. This is total T4, so you know, it talks about 4.6 to 11.2 micrograms per deciliter. In parentheses, 60 to 145 nanomoles per liter. So, yeah, you got to be aware of the units.
TSH is pretty standardized everywhere, right? It has the standardized international.
It's not really harmonized like we would like it to be. But I would say that the reference ranges are much more similar than some other tests where there's a lot of daylight between ranges, so it can be harder to compare, you know, across different labs. But, you know, for the most part, when we're talking about hypothyroidism, I mean, ultimately we're treating people to TSHs that are you know, regardless of the assay, that are going to be fairly similar as far as, no matter which assay we're talking about, the goal TSH is going to be, you know, kind of comparable.
So, okay, so someone comes in with a TSH of like 5, just over the reference range, and their free T4 is normal. It's like 0.8, 0.9, low normal maybe, but normal. I know you guys get a lot of these patients, because I get a lot of these people. They're saying, I'm pretty sure I have hypothyroidism. Now, this is how I presented, by the way, and I'll explain how I did have certain symptoms. What would you do in these types of cases?
So I guess the first thing to note is that a lot of people without thyroid trouble have several symptoms of hypothyroidism just by being alive. So, you know, symptoms of life, so to speak. You know, the symptoms in general for hypothyroidism are incredibly nonspecific, which I think is very frustrating for people, because they read and say, oh, you know, I'm fatigued, my skin's dry, I'm gaining weight, I'm depressed. Must have hypothyroidism, but, you know, those are pretty nonspecific.
It's like 90% of the population.
Yeah. Pretty much.
That's like, oh my
God. So this is why we really need to, you know, rely pretty heavily on some objective measures when the subjective measures really just aren't nearly specific enough. So usually what I would do if I'm not really sure, I mean, yeah, it kind of sounds like it could be hypothyroidism. I like to check something called TPO antibodies, thyroperoxidase antibodies, basically a marker of whether there's an autoimmune attack on the thyroid. So most common cause, as you guys know, of primary hypothyroidism is the immune system decides, I don't like the thyroid. And it just starts making antibodies against an enzyme in the thyroid called thyroperoxidase. And those antibodies can cause a progressive destruction of the thyroid's ability to make thyroid hormone. So in a really borderline case where you have this kind of really mild elevation of TSH, free T4 is normal, and you're trying to build the case that this could indeed be hypothyroidism, if those antibodies are positive, it makes it more likely, in my mind at least, that giving this person thyroid hormone has the potential to make them feel better. Whereas if those antibodies are negative, it's not impossible that they have hypothyroidism. It's just, in my mind, it's a little bit less likely. And of course, there are other factors, you know, it depends on how many symptoms they have and, you know, do they have other autoimmune diseases, since autoimmune diseases tend to travel in clusters? Do they have a family history? You know, all these other things that I'm kind of thinking about. But if the only thing I have to go on is they're tired, gaining weight, skin's dry, and they have a mildly abnormal TSH, you know, I'm not super impressed by that if the TPO antibodies are negative.
And there's, and I can't remember the exact statistic, but a very large percentage of people with that exact scenario with a mildly elevated TSH, especially if they don't have positive TPO, when you recheck it another time, it ends up it being normal. And so we don't want to rely on just one test. And then the other thing along, especially up our alley, is with increasing obesity, adiposity, that actually does sort of drive the TSH up. It's actually part of the compensatory, you know, energy balance mechanisms in obesity. So there's all sorts of little things to consider. And, you know, there are other causes of primary hypothyroidism that we think about, of course, too. So
interestingly, so in medical school, everybody was like taking Adderall. And I was like, well, I don't know. These people are able to sit at the library for hours. And I'm able to sit for like 30 to 60 minutes. And I'm like, well, what are you guys doing? I can't study this long. What are you guys? I've never done this before. And I was like, I got to go get some Adderall. So I went to the doctor and I said, hey, I don't know, everybody's hopped up on Adderall. Can I have some? And he's like, well, we should probably, like, are you tired or something? I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I'm tired. And he's like, all right, let's check your TSH. It was 5.5, I believe. And I was like, what? It's like, I'm ripped. I don't have hypothyroidism.
And you were 24, by the way, or 25 or something. 24. Right? 24.
24. 23, 24. Whatever. So, I'm like, I'm
really
a
really should be
man.
Pretty darn normal.
I'm not an old woman. That's the case study. It's older women get hypothyroidism. Whatever. That's what we read in the textbooks. That's not what I read on Hormones Demystified, by the way. I only get the legit information from there. Anyway, so I was like, whatever. It's probably because I'm drinking so much green tea. It has fluoride and it's blocking the conversion or whatever of the thyroid. So I stopped drinking I'm eating too much bok choy, whatever. So I stopped drinking green tea. And I'm like, let's recheck it in a month. Check it again. My free T4, I think it was like 0.8 or something like that. But my TSH was now 6. And I go, okay, check my antibodies. Like, this is weird. And check them and they're positive. They were positive. Now, question for you. How positive, does it matter the level of the TPO antibodies? Does it just mean if they're elevated, they're elevated? Does it matter if they're like 100 versus 1,000? I can't remember the units, but mine were mildly elevated. I mean, like double the reference range, I think like 100 maybe, something like that, or 6, maybe 80, something like that, because it's usually up to 30, I believe, is the reference.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, for purposes of making a decision about whether to treat somebody, they just need to be elevated above the upper limit of normal. For purposes of, you know, is it important if they're 1,000 versus 100? The conventional answer to that is no, it's probably not important. There are some interesting data out there that people with Hashimoto's, there might be some kind of unknown, you know, as of yet unexplained role of antibodies in certain aspects of pathophysiology, as far as why people with Hashimoto's might feel, let's say, worse than the equivalent person who has, for example, post-surgical hypothyroidism instead of autoimmune hypothyroidism. So there's some interesting stuff there, a couple papers. You know, one paper I think I read, they aspirated a joint and they found TPO antibodies in the joint. And the question was, you know, does the person have joint pain because of the TPO antibody, you know, so there's some interesting stuff out there, but in general, for most purposes of clinical decision making, there's really no benefit to trying to pin it down as far as how high is it and is that worse or better. There's really no worse or better. It's just, is it positive or negative?
Okay.
Yeah. And people are going to ask about, and we did a dietary discussion on thyroid actually earlier, one of our earlier podcasts. And so I've been asked a lot about it because of diet and, you know, endocrinology. And there are some ways to actually improve antibody levels a little bit, like say with selenium supplementation, where that's actually recommended in for Graves' eye disease because of the potential antibody lowering. But the problem is, is that in Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, it might lower, you might be able to lower your antibody levels, but it doesn't matter because they still are positive. It's never been shown to actually make it improve. So that's where, right, you know, people get sort of sucked into that. And unfortunately, we would love to be able to do that. Don't get me wrong. It just, we can't. Although, but people do feel better if they eat a better diet. So if they cut back on refined processed foods and they eat, you know, some more whole foods, and, you know, I'm a big shill for Mr. Peanut, you know, so I talk about eating lots of nuts and seeds, and that includes Brazil nuts, and they have selenium. So I usually end up talking about that. Since you're talking about studies, this is interesting. I just wanted to ask you if you saw, in the past few years, there was a trial. This was surgeons, right, who did this trial where they did thyroidectomies on Hashimoto's patients. And yeah. As I recall, it seemed like they did better than expected compared to the non-Hashimoto's. I can't remember exactly, yeah. But we were all going, what?
Yeah, I did read that study. It was really interesting. The thing that I thought was most interesting about that was it took place in Norway. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I think that that might be relevant here is that the culture in the Scandinavian countries, like Norway, for example, is very different than the culture here. And if you hang with me for a second, I'm going to throw this out there and you can tell me if you disagree or not. But they have kind of a more of a communal sense out there in that the individual is not special, right? It's all about the good of the community. And as such, you're often inclined to be, you know, relatively satisfied with your lot in life because you don't necessarily believe that you are entitled to anything more than what you have. So I think that when it comes to the outcome of that study, they looked at people who were very, very, you know, carefully selected. I think they had the highest, like really high antibody levels. And then they took out the thyroids for some of these people who had really high antibody levels. And they did indeed get better. I think if you kind of compare that to the US, where, you know, you kind of look at our baseline, they do these questionnaires are basically symptom scores, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So sort of the baseline symptom score for people in Norway, as far as just how well they feel, they're way higher than baseline, the same questionnaire in the US. So let's just say that 80 is, I'm doing pretty good overall. You know, I got a few issues, but overall I'm pretty good. So they may be like at an 80 and the US were at like a 50. So,
okay.
I think that there's kind of a fundamental difference in maybe how people view themselves and their health and their interaction with society and what they deserve and all these things in a country like Norway. Whereas here, I do wonder if we would see the same degree of improvement in people who might have very, in the US, who might have very unrealistic expectations. In other words, I think it's possible, at least, that a confounding variable here is people in Norway have lower expectations for what they can achieve in their health than people in the US. So if we were going to try to tell people in the US, hey, listen, I think you should, you know, you still don't feel well and you got Hashimoto's and your labs look perfect and we've tried tweaking your thyroid hormone all over the place, let's take out your thyroid, we would have to screen these people with a level of rigor known only to like NASA in their astronaut training program to really try to figure out, you know, who's going to do well with something like that.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah.
What about, okay, so what about these people that come in stark normal, like TSH is like 2, right? 1 or 2.
Let's say it's 1.5.
Let's say 1.5. Let's say it's like perfect. Free T4, yeah, maybe low normal, but it's normal. It's like,
yeah, say it's normal. 1.1.
And I want to talk about the free T3s, but I also want to talk about if they have positive antibodies because they're just tired, but their euthyroid, their thyroid levels are just stark normal, but they have positive TPO antibodies. And they say, I have Hashimoto's. I feel like crap. Treat me. What's going on there?
Well, I tell you, we get tons of those referrals. So
yes, I'd like to, I want to hear HD's opinion.
So I would say a couple things. One is, again, depending on how many symptoms they have, do they have other autoimmune conditions, what's the family history, and so on, I might be inclined to retest the labs at least once. I would also be interested just to know, did they do that TSH first thing in the morning when TSH, because TSH has kind of a little bit of a circadian rhythm going on, so it's going to be highest in the morning to some extent. I mean, it's kind of a broad period of time over the course of the day, but if they happen to have checked it at like 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and it was at whatever you said, like 1 to 2, it's in theory it's possible that it could be climbing up a little bit closer to 3 if they checked it first thing in the morning, maybe, you know. So I would maybe just repeat it at least once if the story was pretty convincing. But if, you know, if the antibodies are negative, I'm feeling really good that their thyroid function is normal. If their antibodies are positive and with those thyroid function studies, and I repeat them, and they still look just beautiful on paper, but yet they have positive antibodies, I'm usually counseling that person, listen, I really don't think this is your thyroid. Occasionally, they want to know, hey, well, what if I just try some thyroid hormone? You know, is this going to hurt me? You know, the short answer to that is no. If we use a low dose of thyroid hormone, and
goes back to my homeopathic thyroid dosing, the 25 micrograms.
Exactly. You know, we can try a low dose. We can take your TSH of 2 and try to push it down to 0.6. And, you know, I always counsel them just very thoroughly. You got to keep your expectations low for this. Not only do you need to keep your expectations low, but you might feel better initially. And if that benefit persists beyond 6 months, okay, maybe this was indeed a thyroid problem, because almost always a placebo effect or a slight stimulant effect from the hormone itself, either one, those are going to wane by the time you get out to 6 months. So if they have persistent benefit beyond 6 months, sure, could be a thyroid problem. So I will sometimes work with people on that, but I really try to help them look into other things that mimic hypothyroidism symptom-wise before we do that.
Perfect.
And then annual monitoring, because they do have an increased risk of becoming hypothyroidism. Yeah. Or having hypothyroidism for sure in the future. And then if they're females and get pregnant, we're probably going to be all over that. In fact, no, we're definitely going to be all over that, in fact, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Different story with pregnant women, yes.
Okay, so here's the next question. It's pretty clear-cut, elevated TSH. You know, if it's a relatively normal free T4, you get the antibodies positive, sure. If it's the TSH is 5/10 or more, free T4 is low, pretty clear cut. Do you get the antibodies, by the way, on those, or you just straight up treat them? Most people just treat them, but
high TSH, low free T4.
Yeah, without, do you get the antibodies?
Yeah, get the antibodies.
You don't have to.
So I'm just asking. So then here's the next thing. These people are convinced it's their thyroid. They go to an alternative practitioner. What are the most common tests that you see? I know it's probably going to be free T3. We're going to talk about reverse T3. But what are the most common things that I know both of you, because I get these people, both of you get these patients in with these just crazy labs that says, nope, this naturopath or whoever got these labs and says, I'm hypothyroid. The TSH isn't that accurate. The free T4 isn't that accurate. Here's what proves that I have hypothyroidism.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing—they're marketing that they say, well, the mainstream evidence-based doctors, they just go based on TSH and free T4, but they don't know what they're talking about. It's really this, and it's often the reverse T3. So we're excited to hear your, because this is where you come into play for real—the debunking of this stuff.
Yeah, I would say it's probably the two most common tests that I'm going to see in addition to the TSH and the free T4 would be the T3 and the reverse T3, as you've already said. They may go ahead and check some obscure minerals and vitamins and that kind of stuff. And some of it could be helpful, you know, checking the vitamin D, sure, why not? I mean, vitamin D deficiency is common, but I mean, for the most part, it comes down to the T3, the reverse T3. And then also, of course, it comes down to them crossing out the range that the lab listed for right. TSH
yeah.
yes.
and rewriting that range to make a lower upper limit of normal. So if the upper limit of normal was 4, now it's 2.5, let's yep. say.
2.5, I see that.
Yeah. So now, of course, if the person has a TSH of 2.8, that gets flagged as high. And of course, that means they have hypothyroidism. And now it's time to get rolling on the naturopath road to thyroid treatment.
So tell us, why don't we check a free T3? Like, it's the active thyroid hormone. It's the stuff that's making us feel better. But why free T4 and why TSH? You mentioned it earlier. But alluded yeah. to it. But
yeah. why not so free T3? This is one of the hardest things, I think, for people to understand, you know, because T3 is super important. It's the active form of thyroid hormone. It's the form that gets inside the nucleus, gets the job done, binds to the receptors. Why wouldn't you want to know what that level is? Well, a few things. One is the T3 level doesn't really clearly correlate with symptoms. So clinically, it's just often not helpful. You look at a lot of normal people with no thyroid trouble, and their free T3 might be slightly below the lower limit of normal. You look at a lot of people with thyroid trouble, and it could be normal, it could be low, but it doesn't correlate in any study with symptoms reliably. But I'd say one of the big things kind of physiologically is that the T3 level that we can check in the blood, it doesn't correlate with what's happening at the level of the tissues. And that's really the main thing. There's a lot of local control at the tissue level with deiodinase enzymes and all this other stuff. You know, there's conversion of T4 to T3. There's transport of T4 and T3 into the cells. There's binding of the T3. There are all these processes that are happening that we just can't measure. So if we have no lab test for it, we're kind of flying blind to some extent. We just don't know what's happening at the cellular level. So if we check a T3 level in the blood, it can be really misleading. And people still will say, but isn't a low T3 like that? That means something, right? And what I think people also need to really understand is that the body is so good at maintaining homeostasis. So if T3 levels are starting to drop a bit, there's so many steps in the thyroid hormone synthesis and transport and conversion and binding pathway. There's so many other steps that can be upregulated. You know, you can transport more of the hormone into the cell. You can increase the amount of binding to the receptors inside the cells. You can do all these things with T3, even if the blood levels are low, to maintain sort of normal bodily functions, and we can't measure any of that.
I love it.
Here's a question, I guess, and this is for our specialty especially, when people, you know, and I don't think we're going to get too into treatment today. We could certainly. It could be a whole other episode.
Yeah, we should do another
episode. Combine most people do well with what I like to call bioidentical T4, levothyroxine. there is the subset, you know, there's lots of studies without a lot of conclusive evidence that maybe some people do a little bit better on combination therapy, and we could go down that rabbit hole. And some of my fellowship people actually did some of these studies. But then the question becomes, well, who do you even consider doing a little T3? Now, I'm not a big fan of porcine pig thyroid like Armour, just because the ratios aren't like humans. Some people just want that because of natural. I always try to convince them to go bioidentical route if we're going to do that. But who to consider trying some T3? In my case, I like to use, you know, a little bit of the bioidentical T3 called liothyronine cytomel for people. and different real evidence-based endocrinologists really argue about these things. And while most people do great on T4 only, some people might just kind of prefer do a little bit better in vague ways, like wait with a little bit of T3. You know, on UpToDate, which a lot of people use significantly, and I don't know if there's great data for this, they do mention not just people who kind of seem to still have thyroid symptoms despite everything looking pretty good on T4, which is where I generally just try. I just tell people, hey, if it seems like it's a safe situation in you, we can try it. I do want to make sure we're being very holistic by the true nature of that term and making sure their diet, exercise, sleep, and everything else is on point. But they do talk about if the T3 is a little bit low. Let me see if I can I have it up here, if I can find it. I don't know that I know that that's very well evidence-based.
My understanding is that that's not evidence-based, but let's hear what HD says.
They kind of throw it out there, but like, I'm not sure.
Well, we might as well try it.
And just to clarify, who's throwing that out there?
Authors of Up to Date, which is generally a pretty good. Let me see.
It's like the I don't know if you use it, but
yeah, it's
sure.
Candidates for therapy. You know, people who have not felt well on T4 monotherapy since, you know, thyroidectomy, ablation therapy, or, and it says, this is it, who have serum T3 at or below the lower end of the T3 reference range. And they don't cite anything. So these are just, this is like expert opinion, kind of throwing it out there. And I mean, I guess it doesn't really harm. I tell people because of this, and I know that the naturopaths and stuff are saying this too. I'm like, well, what happens if you are one of those people who actually does better on it, but we check the T3 and it's normal? How's that? We always talk about if we check something, how's it going to change our management, right? And so I try to convince them, like, yeah, whatever, we can check it. And not the end of the world, to be honest. We're splitting maybe some hairs, but I'm like, do we need to? Why don't, if you're a good candidate clinically, let's give it a little try and let's be safe about it and see if you feel better. But so... Yeah, I can tell by the way you're looking that you feel the same way I do. Like you don't know that the evidence that supports that little sentence in there.
I can't think of anything I've ever read that really supports that a low T3 level should be a trigger to consider T3 therapy. I mean, for me, it's same as you, Carl. If somebody has really beautiful looking thyroid function studies on levothyroxine, and they still don't feel well, and they have no other plausible explanations, and they've addressed everything else, at least everything we can figure out to address, then sure, I'll try some liothyronine. I think, at least in my experience, the people who have tended to benefit a little bit more, not to say that people with primary hypothyroidism due to Hashimoto's won't benefit, I think they can, but the greatest subset that I've seen is people who've had thyroidectomies, and I would presume that that's because the thyroid makes about 5 micrograms of T3 per day. So if you lose that 5 micrograms and you happen to be very sensitive for whatever reason, you've got the single nucleotide polymorphism, which we're probably not going to get into, or one of those other weird, sort of deiodinase mutation things, or whatever it is, you just may do a little bit better adding in some T3. And, if we're using a fairly reasonable dose, 2.5 to maybe 7.5 to even maybe up to 10 micrograms a day, depending on size of the person, splitting it over 2 doses a day, maybe 3 doses if they're really good at taking thrice daily meds. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with trying that.
I was on Cytomel before. I was on 5 micrograms. I'm not anymore. But some doctor, I don't know who it was, some idiot doctor.
I knew this was coming.
Some idiot doctor was putting in for my 5 micrograms, and instead they put 25 micrograms.
And for some reason that same doctor was getting harassed by his younger brother to put in refills for him that he shouldn't have been doing. But
what idiots do that?
I don't know. A good thing you didn't go into AFib, though.
Well, I don't think I even took any of it. I think I was like, I'm not taking this thing. I'm going to die.
I can't believe it. Yeah, all right.
Anyway.
So now the big question. So here's this is the meat of this podcast, the reverse T3.
Yeah.
Because this is what the integrative, functional, alternative doctors, naturopaths, all these guys say that patients have to get, and a lot of patients are convinced of it. And I from my understanding of the data and experience is that there are a couple different areas where I've very rarely ever used it. You know, if we're confused in the hospital and critical care settings, we've always said. And there's also a very rare, hypermetabolic like liver disease where they consumptive hypothyroidism, where I guess it can help, where it's like churning through it, and it's like a hypermetabolic issue of it. But those are exceedingly rare. So in almost everybody, 99.99999% of people, why are they saying that reverse T3 is the best test and the rest of us really evidence-based doctors don't get it, other than the fact that it's expensive and takes 8 weeks to come back?
What is reverse T3? Explain this to the...
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to explain this as simply as I possibly can, just because I know that people are not necessarily looking at the graphic of how thyroid hormone is metabolized. But so just if people will bear with me for a second, just picture that you've got T4, right? That's the form of thyroid hormone that the thyroid is mostly making. And that has to be converted to T3, the active form. That process of conversion happens using the deiodinase enzymes. Okay, so the deiodinase enzymes D1, D2, D3. These enzymes are responsible for metabolizing the various forms of thyroid hormone into some other form of thyroid hormone. So T4 gets converted to T3, but it also can be converted to reverse T3. So essentially, when T4 is converted to reverse T3, it's just getting inactivated. And reverse T3 doesn't have any known biologic function. There are some claims made, and we can jump into those, by AltMed, that it blocks the binding of T3 to its receptors. It does not do that. But that's what reverse T3 is. It's just kind of a way, because everything in the whole thyroid hormone pathway, like everything's always getting activated, inactivated, reactivated. I mean, this is sort of how we just kind of twist the dials and fine tune things in the body as far as keeping the levels where we need them to be. So, you know, as Carl already alluded to, reverse T3 doesn't have a whole lot of utility. The main place where it was sort of useful in the past, and I don't know if anyone even checks it in critical illness anymore, but sometimes people would come into the ICU super sick with really funky looking thyroid function study numbers, and the docs would be scratching their heads going, do they have a thyroid problem here? Do they have central hypothyroidism? Is there something going on in the brain? What's happening? And in those circumstances, checking reverse T3 was thought to maybe be useful. Although, of course, it took a while to come back. And, you know, by the time it came back, the person was either out of the ICU or out of the ICU one way or the other, right?
Right, right.
Not to be morbid. But so it doesn't have a whole lot of utility at this point. There are some claims made, but before jumping into the claims, maybe it would be helpful to even talk about why it can't be used in the way that AltMed often tries to use it. So, you know, a lot of times what they like to do is they use reverse T3 levels, not just to try to make some kind of diagnosis of hypothyroidism, but actually to guide thyroid hormone replacement therapy. And the reason why, well, there's several reasons why you just can't do that. First of all, the levothyroxine that people are often taking cross-reacts with an immunoassay that's used to check reverse T3. So if reverse T3 is being checked by a certain kind of blood test called an immunoassay, the levothyroxine is going to register in that assay. It's going to make the RT3 level look high. And that's going to make the naturopath say, aha, your reverse T3 is high. I knew it. You're undertreated. We have to jack up your dose. So that's the first problem. Second problem is that if you remember what we were just talking about before, when you've got T4, it can be activated to T3. Or sorry, it could be converted to T3, the active form of thyroid hormone, or that T4 can be converted to reverse T3, the inactive form. Just basic stoichiometry of chemistry. If you load up the left side of the chemical equation, you will drive that equation to the right. So if you give people escalating doses of levothyroxine, you will both produce more T3 and you will produce more reverse T3. That's just going to happen. So a high level of reverse T3 often just means that you're increasing their dose of thyroid hormone. That's all it means. So, and then the last thing I guess I would say about reverse T3 is it, the half-life of it is 4 hours. If you look at the half-life of T3, it's about a day. If you look at the half-life of T4, it's like 5 to 9 days. So when you're checking a blood test for something you're trying to make decisions about to see how somebody's been doing over the last month or two, why would you check something that has a half-life of 4 hours? It just reflects what's been going on very, very recently, not what's been going on over the last month, or at least not necessarily. So it's just, it doesn't even have the basis or for what should form the basis of a test that has any hope of utility whatsoever.
Yeah.
So that should be enough to make people say, oh yeah, okay, this isn't going to be useful. But that's not what happens.
I was going to say, but.
Yeah, but, you know, there are all these claims. They say, well, if reverse T3 is elevated, that's the best marker for what they call tissue hypothyroidism. Now, I did say before, people will certainly call me on this. They'll say, but you said, HD, you said that T3 levels in the blood don't tell you what's going on in the tissues. There's all this stuff happening behind the scenes in the tissues that we can't measure. So how do you know that reverse T3 isn't a marker for tissue hypothyroidism? The main evidence that AltMed cites to support that claim, that that's what's going on, is they cite the evidence for critical illness, non-thyroidal illness, we call it NTI. And as far as I know in the literature, non-thyroidal illness is basically something where you'll see funky thyroid function tests in people who are really, really sick. So if you are walking around, typical outpatient, and the chance that you have non-thyroidal illness to account for some funky thyroid numbers should be close to zero. So people, and I know AltMed will often say, well, they have, you know, depression and fibromyalgia and all these other things that can cause the thyroid to be messed up. And to my knowledge, there is no evidence for that. So I think the evidence they cite that reverse T3 is a marker for tissue hypothyroidism, it all comes from the evidence in non-thyroidal illness. And I don't believe that the typical outpatient has non-thyroidal illness. So I think that that's kind of refuted there. They also talk about how T4 therapy alone is thought to be ineffective if the reverse T3 is high. And that's basically, that's based on what we were just talking about, where if you load up the person with T4, you're going to drive more conversion to both T3 and reverse T3, because that's just what happens. So the reverse T3 is high, yeah, sure, because you're giving them more thyroid hormone. It doesn't imply that T4 alone is ineffective in any way. Another thing they say is that elevated reverse T3 prevents T3 from binding to receptors, like at the tissue level, the cellular level. And that's gonna be what causes the problem. It's just, it blocks the T3. The thing is that there is actually research on this, and it shows that reverse T3 doesn't bind to thyroid hormone receptors. It swims around, you know, it's there, but it doesn't bind. But it also doesn't enter the nucleus. And that's been proven. So if you're going to say T3 is the active form of thyroid hormone, gets the job done by getting into the nucleus, binding to receptors, all this stuff, but reverse T3 blocks that, well, reverse T3 would have to get inside the nucleus, and it doesn't. So I would say the last thing that they say that has no good evidence behind it, and the only reason I bring this up is just because the study they cite for this one is so much fun to talk about, because it would never get through an IRB, an internal review board. Institutional review board nowadays. They say that, well, elevated reverse T3 decreases your metabolic rate. So if you're having trouble losing weight, let's check your reverse T3, because if it's high, that's what's responsible for your reduced metabolic rate, which must explain your weight gain. And they say that the mechanism for that is that the high reverse T3 decreases T4 to T3 conversion. So they cite some studies like from cockatoos and other animals and stuff like that just don't go to prove it at all. But then there was a study in humans. It was 1959. And what they did was they took a few people who had hypothyroidism, a few people who had hyperthyroidism, so an overactive thyroid, and then some euthyroid people, meaning normal thyroid function. And they gave each of the three groups these huge doses of reverse T3 in pill form, which, you know, I didn't even know was a thing, but apparently you could give people these huge doses of reverse T3, and they wanted to see what happened to them, what happened to their metabolic rates. So they found that the metabolic rate after giving reverse T3 pills was totally unchanged in the euthyroid people and in the hyperthyroid people. But in three out of the four hypothyroid people who they studied, their BMR went down. They didn't have any hypothyroid symptoms, but their BMR went down a bit. And the thing that I think this is a broader lesson for people, the thing that people need to understand is that if you take a naturally occurring hormone or any substance and you give people a huge pharmacologic dose of that substance, you are not telling yourself anything about what happens sort of in the course of normal physiologic production of that substance. So as kind of an analogy, think about cortisol. Cortisol comes from the adrenal glands, right? It does a lot. Super important hormone, does a ton of things. Now, let's say I give somebody a synthetic version of something very similar to cortisol, prednisone. Prednisone, people will know, is a steroid hormone, very similar to cortisol. If I give someone giant doses of prednisone for a long time, what's going to happen? I'm going to totally shred their bone density. I'm going to suppress their immune function. I'm going to make them gain weight. So can I extrapolate from that and say that cortisol is a terrible hormone that shreds your bone density, suppresses your immune function, and makes you gain weight? Now, of course, nobody would say that because it's an important hormone that in the course of normal physiologic production does all sorts of normal bodily processes. So it's the same thing with reverse T3. You give a giant pharmacologic dose, it's totally different than what happens with regular T3.
Well, then, so I don't know about that study, but was it a placebo-blinded crossover study? Like, did they even do any of the stuff that's like, you know, good practice and even detecting
There was nothing like that. It was just the measuring people's BMR both before
Setting up an RCT, physiologic doses of RT3, placebo-blinded crossover study.
And another thing, I guess I never hear if these guys make any claims of this, but are there any therapeutic trials of giving thyroid hormone to those who have elevated reverse T3? Because that would be
zero.
You know, I mean, and there's nothing, right? Okay.
Yeah. As far as I know, zero.
The only people that I've seen with elevated reverse T3s, because they make me get it, of course, I'm not getting it routinely. People like competitive bodybuilder athletes, women who are super dieted down, and they almost have this like,
they have a hint of a sick euthyroid.
Yeah, that's what it looks like, sick euthyroid, and their RT3 levels are a little bit out. And just this is anecdotally, and people who force me to, you better get this right. I'm like, all right, fine, I'll order it for you, whatever.
But I think that makes sense.
That would make sense.
And it's very
to
similar.
Me.
It's similar to, you know, the female athlete triad, hypothalamic amenorrhea, in guys who get really really lean wrestlers. We've probably all been hypogonadal at some point. I think that's part of it. Yeah. But again, what are we going to do about it?
Stop dieting.
Stop. Or at least being so extreme.
Stop,
you know,
starving and yourself.
Right.
So these are the biggest. Okay, so for those who are listening, for the love of God, don't force your doctor to get an RT3. If somebody says get a reverse T3, your doctor, practitioner, naturopath, whoever it is, doesn't know what the hell they're talking about. They just don't. And you can have them cite the study. They're probably going to cite the same studies that HD just discussed here. But I see this stuff all the time. I see blogs about it. I see people on social media. Yeah. You need to get these. If your doctor only gets a TSH, then you need a new doctor. It's like, okay. Well,
it's a whole marketing scam.
If we're looking at trying to help people naturally, we shouldn't be trying to find weird ways to get people on unnatural hormones. I don't care if the thyroid is technically natural. If it's not natural to have to go on it, unless you're having a pathophysiological change in your body. Like me, I have Hashimoto's, so my thyroid's slowly dying. It's dead now. I am on a whopping dose of synth. I'm actually not on the Cytomel anymore. I felt like, I don't know, felt like maybe it was making me not sleep as well or something. I'm not sure, but now my cholesterol is a little bit elevated compared to before, and maybe not as lean. I'm not sure. Yeah. Not really.
It's all very ironic that the and you know, to be fair, I think there are some naturopaths. I feel like I know some who just really want to help people with their diet, exercise, sleep, and
yeah,
and all that stuff. And then they know that if there's a real medical problem, they shift them over to the medical physicians. And on the same end, there are MDs and DOs and, you know, nurses and nurse practitioners and PAs who go way to the extreme of these routes. And then, yeah, they claim to be holistic and trying to help with natural stuff. And then they're always trying to find a reason to give medicines and supplements. And it's like, well, hold on, let's actually be holistic and work on your diet, exercise, sleep, and stress reduction, easier said than done, and make sure there's not anything else going on. So that's my two cents on that.
Any other weird testing that people, I mean, I know there's all those other older tests that people used to get, but I think you pretty much nailed it there.
I think that encompasses most of what I've seen for wacky thyroid testing.
Yeah, that was great. I mean, I feel like I've been through all the training and stuff, read about it at some point, read your blogs, but hearing you discuss it, helps me feel like I can explain it.
Thyroglobulin antibodies. I think you've wrote about this before, because they'll say if your TPO is negative, got to get your thyroglobulin antibodies. Anything real quick on that? I know you basically say that's not something to actually test.
Yeah, it's a problem when a provider of some stripe is trying to diagnose hypothyroidism by checking that, because those antibodies are very nonspecific, and they can be elevated in lots of people who don't actually have a predisposition toward developing Hashimoto's. So you're going to falsely diagnose people because you just get too many false positives. The only time we really check antibodies, thyroglobulin antibodies, is when we pair it with a thyroglobulin, and that's only for following people who've had thyroidectomies after thyroid cancer, looking for tumor recurrence. So it really shouldn't be used at all in someone who has a thyroid. It doesn't tell you anything useful.
Iodine testing, urine iodines.
Oh, iodines, yeah. I mean, iodine's a good one. I mean, it's not a good one to test, but I guess it's a good one to talk about, because there's no good test. I've seen practitioners, AltMed providers, who check serum iodine, which I think in general is going to reflect recent dietary exposure to iodine as opposed to any type of reflection of your overall iodine stores and your sufficiency status. And then, you know, the urine iodine, the 24-hour collection, it's a better test, but it's more of a populational health test, and people have a hard time wrapping their brains around this one. You know, that the data that you can find about what urinary iodine tells you has been used to determine if populations as a whole are iodine sufficient. So in other words, if they're excreting above a certain level of iodine in the urine as a population, that population is thought to probably be iodine sufficient, and, you know, they don't necessarily need to worry as much about supplementation unless, you know, they're pregnant or something. But if you take the individual person, it becomes a lot harder to say, oh, hey, your urinary iodine's a bit low, that must mean you need to take iodine. It's not really designed to be used that way. It's more of a populational average metric type of thing. So I would say if people are worried that they might be iodine insufficient, just take a multivitamin that has a normal amount of iodine in it, not a mega dose, which can cause its own problems with the thyroid, but just normal multivitamin.
Right. So since we're talking about it, I'm just going to ask, I don't really ever do this because we generally avoid it, but in my training it seemed like all too often people were getting like CT scans with iodinated contrast, and yet they needed to get treated for their thyroid cancer with radioactive iodine, and so people were getting iodine levels, mostly the urine, to see when they would get down close enough so that we felt like we could benefit from the radioactive iodine. I mean, I
I generally guilty as charged. I've done that. Yes, I've absolutely done that. And
okay.
It was for that purpose, which is still not maybe totally kosher, but we don't have that many different ways of seeing, you know, whether that person has excreted the load unless we just wait beyond a certain number of months and just assume it's gone.
And then the other little anecdote for this is I've had at least two or three people. And again, I feel like there's a little bit of a selection bias. Maybe the three of us probably could get this. I've definitely had a few people who had primary hypothyroidism, antibodies negative, and I was like, what is going on? And it turned out, and I think they ended up referred to me because they were like trying to be very organic and they only, like they didn't get any iodized salt.
Yeah.
Like they were doing like the sea salt or whatever. And it's like, holy, I mean, so we always tell people, well, you know, in the United States, Hashimoto's is pretty much the cause of, if there's not an obvious surgery or radiation or whatever, of primary hypothyroidism. But historically in other countries, iodine deficiency was, and maybe in some places still is, but people apparently cause themselves to have iodine deficiency. It seems like it took very significant effort on their parts to cause that. But I tell people don't go to the, you know, enjoy some iodized salt once in a while.
Absolutely.
I guess I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but
no, I'm with you on that.
All right. Cool.
Very good. Anything else, Spence? No, I think that's good. That pretty much covers testing for hypothyroidism. I hope we can have you back on our podcast because we should probably, I mean, there's all sorts of different stuff that we can discuss, but any last closing remarks, HD?
I would just plead with people to bring whatever testing and recommendations they get from their AltMed provider back to an actual physician or other healthcare provider who has been trained more in the mainstream conventionally, and get their advice and then listen to their advice. That's the best I can ask for. The
best you can offer. Well, make sure if you're listening to this and if you're interested for more information, go to hormonesdemystified.com. And there's just, I'm going to use this word, Casey's favorite word, plethora. There's a plethora of data and blogs all about this. Goes into even more depth than what we discussed here, but I think we got the gist of it for thyroid testing. But thank you so much. Really good resource.
Yeah,
thank you so much for coming.
This was great.
An honor.
My pleasure. Thanks.
To have you on. Great wealth of knowledge. So thank you. Thank you again.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.